This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
Holly Nelson is the founder of The Connection Couch, a platform dedicated to creating safe and supportive spaces for couples and individuals to explore intimacy, sexuality, and emotional connection. As a licensed professional counselor with a Master of Science in Clinical Mental Health Counseling, Holly has been providing mental health care for the past 5 years. During the first year of her career, Holly discovered her ultimate passion is helping people create thriving, vibrant connections to their sexuality and within their romantic relationships. Sex-positive, queer and kink-affirming therapist, celebrating and welcome diversity and erotic expression, sexual lifestyle, gender and neurodivergence into her office. Holly is a dedicated professional, EMDR certified and has completed advanced EFT trainings. Holly is also taking her sex therapy skills to the next level by pursuing a certification through ASECT. Gosh, there's a lot there. Thank you again for joining us. I forget people don't know what they are, but they're all good acronyms to people that are listening. But I did want to start, if it's okay, by just taking you back a little bit from where you are today to your teenage years, your formative years. Do you think the person you were then would recognize who you are today? And is there a link between the two?
Yes, I think so. Obviously, you know, my younger teenage self got me to where I am today. I think I was rebellious for the culture that I grew up in. I was raised LDS or Mormon is probably more commonly known. There's a lot of boxes that you have to check, and it can be very oppressive, you know, for women, queer people. And so breaking free of those, it caused a lot of drama with, you know, my parents and in my personal life. And so I would say that same fire, that same determination is just channeled in a different, probably more healthy, impactful way than it was during my teenage years.
Mm. We fairly confident and comfortable in your body and in your desire when you were relatively young, or is that something that came later?
No, absolutely not. Yeah, I had lots of insecurities, and I think, you know, just because of the culture that I was raised in, I really didn't know anything about my body or my sexuality at the time. All I knew is what was, you know, taught to me through church, you know, that it's for having babies, and kind of, you know, through the media just tailored to, you know, this patriarchal, like, male's perspective of what sexuality and intimacy is.
And what was it that led you to, I guess, try and figure it out for yourself, trying to look for different resources to try and explore what the church and family and school wasn't telling you? What was it that inspired you to do that?
Yeah, I think I just carried a lot of shame and not even really knowing how to put that into words or language at the time, but I just didn't like how that culture, that environment made me feel. So, you know, it started off as, you know, rebelling as teenagers do, lots of drinking, partying, but then later, you know, I was able to connect dots of, oh, this is why I don't like it from, I guess, a more, what's the word I'm looking for? Just human rights standpoint.
Yeah. And we were talking a bit before we hit record about people that have shame or still feel there's a stigma and taboo around talking about intimacy, pleasure, and those sort of things. And it's kind of, I think money and sex are the two things we don't like talking about. Both of which are pretty important. And why don't we talk about pleasure? Why do people find it hard to have that conversation, do you think?
Yeah, I think because there's a lot of shame around it, and when people aren't taught how to talk about it and taught that it's taboo or bad, then we can't expect them to be very good at it or even know where to, you know, begin asking those questions without fear of judgment or, you know, getting it wrong. And ultimately, I think learning requires that we open ourselves up to getting it wrong. But then there's, you know, all this shame and other things that are barriers.
Mm. And when you started doing the mental health counseling and study for the qualifications and started doing the work in the field, what was it that sort of led you towards this area? Because a lot of therapists, obviously a lot of therapists are very good and talk about lots of things that are very important, but there is still the sort of sex and intimacy therapist or a sort of sexual trauma therapist or somebody in this space is still relatively unusual. So what was it that pulled you to the side of things?
Yeah, I think in like my master's program, I didn't even know that this was an option. And I just kind of lucked into the clinic that I ended up in for my internship and associate level hours. And she was going through her ASEC certification, my supervisor. Mm-hmm. And so she was amazing. She taught me everything I knew about sex and bodies. And she's just, her personality is just so fun. And, you know, she made talking and learning about those things just fun. And I didn't realize that, you know, work could be that enjoyable.
It's quite unusual, isn't it? Very few people get to do the work that they love. And I think it really shows when, I think something like you do, the work you do, I feel it's almost it's as much a calling as a career. So I don't think you just decide to do it. And because it obviously comes with a lot of responsibility. You hear at times, I'm sure, things that are very traumatic and very difficult. And
yes.
Yeah, it must be something that you really felt compelled to do.
Absolutely, yes. And it's just fun and extremely fulfilling.
And what was it, so after the training, after learning, what was it that inspired you to create the Connection Couch? What was it that pulled it all together?
I think independence, just wanting to be able to do my own thing, see the clients that I, you know, really feel like I am able to help the best. And in doing so, you know, I'm able to show up for those clients better because it's what I love and what I'm passionate about. And that, you know, transfers through.
It's such a thing as a, I think I know the answer before I even say it, but is there such a thing as a typical client or a typical set of challenges people come to you with? Or is everything so unique?
I mean, I think typical in the sense that most of the people that I work with have some sort of either shame, trauma, or anxiety, which can all intersect and overlap that they come to me to work through.
And how do you start with people? How do you meet them where they are when they have the conversation?
Yeah, I think the first step is making them feel safe and comfortable, and then anything that they want to talk about is on their terms when they're ready. You know, if they just want to shoot the shit for the first little bit until they get comfortable with me, there's, you know, it's all about, my job is to take the pressure off.
So I think a lot of times some of the things that they're saying to you, they might not have said out loud before. So some of the things that they want to sort of talk about, it's a big thing. And I think a lot of people perhaps hide some of the trauma or difficulties or shame that they've had away. And then when they bring it out, it's hard. What do you think they expect? Do we have to sort of go into the trauma or into the shame, or do we have to respect that it exists and then move forward from there? How do people progress when they've perhaps had difficulties in the past, or they feel that they're somehow thinking, feeling, doing something that's shameful? How do people move forward from that?
Yeah. I think, again, yes, we do need to move into it when they're ready, at their own pace. But we need to get to the root. When did this belief about, yourself as a sexual being first develop? What was the memory? What was the incident? And then, I think oftentimes just having, that non-judgmental presence, because I think that's what their biggest fear is, is this person going to judge me for whatever it is that I'm sharing with them? Having someone that is accepting and normalizes, their humanity, as long as whatever their sexual preferences are consensual, respects other people's boundaries, things like that, is in and of itself very healing.
So I think perhaps a lot of the time when people have been in relationships for a period of time, and depending on the relationship, it could be it could be a year, could be 30 years. Mm-hmm. There's obviously things that we perhaps enjoyed or weren't looking to explore when we got together that perhaps have changed over the course of time. So mm-hmm. when you have a dynamic where perhaps one person maybe has had something in their mind for a couple of years or even longer, how can those conversations be facilitated? Because you don't want to just spring something on your partner and just sort of throw it. Oh my goodness, what? So how do you have that discussion?
Yeah. I think normalizing that sexuality, sexual preferences, libido, all of it is going to change and evolve over, the course of a lifetime. And that's a beautiful thing, because sexuality is something that should be explored and enjoyed, and it would be boring if it stayed the same. But I think, having that third party person that can kind of serve as that buffer of, dealing with the partner's emotional response, which is also just as valid as, maybe what the other partner is sharing, and, hold space for there's fear of what if I'm not able to meet my partner, in their sexual needs, and then where does that leave us? There might be, the other partner might be carrying shame too of, I've been told that this is bad. And so just serving as that buffer, but then providing, education and teaching couples how to negotiate, because we all have to learn how to negotiate, what we want, intimately.
And I sometimes think that's one thing that the BDSM and kink community can sort of teach people that perhaps slightly more vanilla, that part of the whole thing with BDSM in particular is the negotiation, the agreement, the safe words, the this, the that, the yes, the no, the maybe. Whereas in a sort of, a sort of heteronormative sex relationship, we pretty much have a mental checklist, like a bit of kissing, touch your breast, maybe go down on a... We've done, we've had sex. Whereas, and you said the word right at the very beginning, which I really loved, was pleasure. I think if we could somehow take the word sex out of the equation and place it with the word pleasure, it would be far more meaningful. Because I'm in my mid-50s now, so my erections aren't always as hard as used to be. Might be difficult to get it up, might be difficult to stay hard for longer. And my wife might be going through perimenopause or menopause or whatever. So the sex we were having when we were 20, it is going to be different, but that doesn't mean we can't hold each other, kiss each other, mutual masturbation or sex, whatever. Yeah. All these things are incredibly pleasurable. And sometimes that whole fixation that perhaps society's created around ejaculation and orgasm, that's the aim. If you don't achieve orgasm, then it's been a failed experience. And I just think there's, gosh, I'm no idea what the question is now. But it just feels that we can learn so much from, as I say, BDSM, where they talk about things far more. We just don't talk about things. We just carry on as we've always done, I suppose, which...
Right. Like, again, and that goes back to nobody's taught us how to talk about it. How are we supposed to know how to hold space for our partner when they tell us about a fantasy and then communicate our comfortability and see if we can find some sort of compromise within that?
Because that's the thing, isn't it? Sometimes when we have a fantasy, the whole thing about fantasies is something that we fantasize and imagine and think about. It's not necessarily saying we want to experience that particular fantasy itself. We might fantasize about sleeping with somebody else, but actually what might be even more enjoyable is role-playing with our partner, meeting them at a hotel, not knowing them. And that, delivers the same thing almost in a way, but it's, I think sometimes that's the issue we have, is that we have this fantasy. Oh my goodness, am I not good enough for you? And it's no. And it's almost how, like you said, how do you break it down? So what is it you're actually looking for? It's not to bring somebody else into the marriage. It's not to go and pick up strange people. It's, what is it to do? And I think that's an important.
Yeah. I think with that one, they're probably looking for like excitement, novelty. And you can totally create that within your relationship, because you're absolutely right. Like the fantasy of, having an affair is very different than the reality of actually doing it. And, many people don't want all that stress. They don't want to live a double life. They're just looking for the excitement, the adventure.
Yeah. An ex-colleague of mine, so he had an affair and was, when I was coming to work, and sort of talk about it. And so I was like, oh my gosh, it was amazing. We went to this hotel and we met in the bar and we did this. And then we went away for the weekend to Paris. It was so wonderful. Oh my gosh, why is my normal married life not like that? You think, well, because literally you go into a wonderful hotel, having wonderful food, there's no kids, there's no washing, there's no shopping, there's no life, no wrap around. We can do it within your marriage. And it's, and that didn't end well, as you can imagine. But it's kind of weird, isn't it, where we sort of think, wow, I wonder why this is so perfect, this affair I'm having. Because you're taking away all the things that make life complicated and messy. And who wants to think about sex when you've had, worried about the children, you're just doing the washing, you put the dishes away.
Stress, bills.
It's in the bedroom next door. Your bills to pay and stuff. It's going to be different. But I guess it's trying to sort of carve out time to remember what brought you together in the first place, I suppose.
Yeah. I think, are you familiar with Esther Perel?
No.
Okay. So she's big in the therapy world and sex and couples. I can't remember where she's from. She's from Europe, but she talks about like in long-term relationships, human beings kind of want two things. We want safety, comfort, security, but we also want adventure, excitement, novelty. And when we get into a long-term relationship, we kind of give up the adventure, the excitement, and the novelty for more of safety, comfort, and security. So it's, a paradox that if you're in a long-term monogamous relationship, that you kind of have to learn how to balance and meet both of those needs.
How important do you think it is to love yourself, really love yourself, before you can expect or almost explain what that feels like to somebody else?
Oh, so, so important.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think, we can't give to others what we haven't gone in depth with within ourselves.
When would you first say that you first love yourself?
That's a good question. I got sent away in my teenage years, and I was sent to a program. It was a wilderness program, and I know there's like horror stories about some out there, but the one I went to was actually a phenomenal program. It, really gave me the foundation, and I attribute part of that to being where I am today. And so I think it was through that program, just spending time in nature, that I was able to like really, love myself, flaws and all.
And did that help you recognize or determine what you were looking for in somebody else, and what a relationship looked like for you?
Yes, but I think, at the time, still being very young, there was still lots of, experiences that I needed to learn and have to figure out, what does a healthy relationship look like? What parts of myself have I still, not faced? Kind of like that shadow work, bringing, those hidden parts of myself to the light and figuring out which ones still needed to be healed.
And are there still moments in your own life where you feel uncertain about things, or are you pretty much, fixed is the wrong word, are you pretty much, you know where you are and what you're looking for and
Yeah,
are together?
yeah. I mean, I think, I'm with my life partner now, and he's a wonderful human, and I could not be more fortunate in that sense. Do I think, the journey of self-love and self-exploration is lifelong? Yes. But I think I found, my person to kind of face those all the craziness of life with.
Did you know pretty early on that he was the person, he or she was the person?
I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. Like, I think yes, but I think it's become even more clear, the different thing, the hard, like I guess the challenges that we face together, that he's more my person now than he was then, and he still was my person then.
Do you think there are there daily practices, things that people can do that help cultivate intimacy with themselves and with others? Are there things that we could or should be doing daily?
Yes. I mean, I think, taking time for yourself, doing things that you enjoy, that you love, are wonderful forms of self-love and self-care. I think also, taking time for sensuality. So turning off the TV, turning off we have screens everywhere in front of our faces all the
Do
time.
we do.
So when, and that could be as simple as, like mindful eating. Turning off the TV, really paying attention to the different tastes, flavors, textures, really tuning in to your senses.
It's funny you say that, because I always think that food and wonderful food and drink is probably the closest analogy that there is to wonderful sex and intimacy. And you sort of hope that you wouldn't be on your smartphone while you're having sex or watching TV or whatever. Maybe depending what's on TV. But with eating though, so you just see it everywhere, whether it be in a restaurant or at home or at friends' houses, whatever. That people just and any. I'm sure you could ask them half an hour later. So, what was the food like? What did you eat? I'm sure half people wouldn't be able to tell you what they ate. And but there's just something. And the other day, it's probably the right. It's the right. It's the right time of year here for peaches and nectarines.
Oh,
And
delicious, my favorite.
I had a peach, and I had to eat it over the sink this morning because it was so juicy. And oh my goodness, this is going to
So
sound really,
envious.
it's going to sound weird. It almost felt like quite, it almost felt quite a sexual experience. It was so juicy and
Yes,
fresh, and the scent of it
yes.
and the smell and the juices running everywhere. And it was just, I thought, I could have probably eaten this in front of the television or just not even thought about it. But actually, just allowing ourselves to luxuriate in that peach for a minute or two was really, really, it was very different. And it did feel quite erotic in a way.
Absolutely. That's what an erotic experience is. It's tapping in, dropping into your body, tuning in to your senses. And I think that's why people struggle with sex because, again, it's been, something that has to be so performative, and they're constantly worrying, like, what is my partner thinking? Or, again, about the orgasm or the outcome. When really, if we would just drop into our bodies, focus on sensation, pleasure, connection, it's a different experience.
I'm sure a lot of people listening now, if they thought about what was their favorite sensual or the most memorable sensual sexual experience, I'm sure a lot of the times it wasn't actually penetration or orgasm. It was just something else, really.
Probably.
For me, I'm sure it was, but it was. But I just, I just, like I say, we from society, from in particular, from our easy access to porn that we see. And I think if you're relatively young, and I think the average age that boys in particular access porn now is 11 or 12, which it's pretty young to know what's going on,
So
really.
young.
You're watching this normally you're watching a 3 or 4 minute clip, and
Right.
all the women that you see are hairless below their neck. Everybody, all the men have large penises, they stay hard for a long time, they ejaculate a huge amount, and everybody seems to like, multiple partners or whatever. And you watch that and you think, oh, is that what I'm supposed to be doing? And it's hard. And I think certainly when I was younger, porn was a long time ago, porn was a magazine at best. And that was, oh my goodness, there's a naked woman in here. My goodness, it was so amazing. Whereas now, oh my goodness, I think Pornhub alone gets 4 billion hits a month. They're not all accidental. Some of those are people looking for it. So what do you find couples coming to you that where porn becomes a problem, or people feel almost that they are failing because they're not having porn-like sex?
Yes, absolutely. And I wouldn't even argue that porn is inherently the problem. I would argue that we're not talking, at least in the US, there's no standardized, comprehensive sex education. And then people are going, teens are going to porn, and it's getting younger and younger because it's so readily accessible and easy to access. And that's where they're getting their information about sex. And yes, it is going to be this performative, kind of, misogynistic, sexist view of what a sexual experience is. But porn was created for adult entertainment, and it's for fantasy and arousal purposes only. It was never meant to be educational.
It's funny you say that, because I've talked to sort of porn actors, actresses, and directors, and they said exactly the same things. Look, and I don't have an issue with porn in terms of for entertainment purposes for adults.
Morality. Yeah.
Yeah, from a moral standpoint, if people want to do that, absolutely fine. But it's for in their words, it literally is they would hate to think it was used for education and not for entertainment. And I talked to
Yes.
a couple of amazing female directors that direct feminist porn or holistic
Yes.
porn, or worse. The stories are much better, and it's much more what's going to turn on a woman. And it's still hardcore porn. I mean, it's not sort of softcore, soft lighting and everything, but it's got a proper story. There's talk about
Yes.
consent, there's talk about what does a woman enjoy, all those things. And it is a very, very different experience than the almost the fast food version of porn that you get in Pornhub, which is just a clip to try and get yourself off very quickly. And it's very, very, so there is, if you look for it, there is some really, really good porn out there, some very erotic, sensual
Yes, I
material, but
agree. I'm a
couple
big
or
fan
whatever.
of, yeah, I'm a big fan of feminist porn.
Yeah, I
It's
talked to, I think, Inka Winters, and she was fabulous, a porn director, and she some really high budget films. They're not porn films, they're films that happen to have sex in them, and really enjoyable. And as a couple watching it, it's great. It's entertainment. It's like watching any other film, really. But yeah, some of the other stuff, if you watch the, I don't know, Brazzers or some of the sort of quick porn that's on these websites, it's not yeah, it's not what intimacy is about, really. It really
right.
isn't.
No, not at all. It doesn't account for having, you know, sex or intimacy with a real person. It doesn't help you know what to do if there's pain or, you know, consent, all of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you find that people still come to you thinking they've got a kink or desire that nobody else has ever had?
Yes, yes. And some of them.
Do they? Have you ever had one of them? I've never, ever, ever heard that before.
No, no. Even like I had years ago, like ABDL, you know, adult baby diaper lover.
Yeah.
That's still a very common fetish or kink out there. Yeah. So, yeah, no, I've yet to hear one that isn't common. Maybe. Well, it's not mainstream, but still common.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you think of this, what, 8 billion people on the planet, the possibility that somebody else isn't into sex, wearing gloves, scarf, and a beret. There's somebody else that likes that. Or right. somebody else that right. likes, or whatever the things are, there's always going to be somebody else that likes that. But I guess, again, because it's not necessarily talked about, we think, oh my gosh, how am I going to possibly mention this to my partner?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, if there is, you know, a history of maybe like a religious upbringing, there's just so much more shame and it is more taboo to talk about it and bring it up with your partner.
Do you find it very different when you're working with individuals versus couples? Is it a very different approach you take?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll typically use very different like therapy modalities, and just with two people in the room, it's gonna be a little bit more exciting because you know you're trying to make each person feel heard and understood, and also working with the two of their you know relationship dynamics that sometimes can be a little bit maybe fiery is a good word for it. So.
Yeah, I always imagine that if a couple comes to see a therapist, that there's generally one that's slightly more keen than the other. I never imagine, you know, sitting with a partner and just opposite ends of the couch thinking, we should go and see a therapist. Why don't we do that? One of them, persuaded, and it's,
Well, I think that yes, that is a common experience, but I think it's also becoming even more common that, especially with sex therapy, that both partners want to be there. Because by the time a couple's ready to do sex therapy, oftentimes they've worked through like maybe some of the other issues like communication, that sort of thing. And then they both really want, you know, that thriving sex life together. So That's one of the perks of doing couple sex therapy is they're a little bit easier to work with by the time they get to me.
Mm. What's the biggest change you've seen in a couple? So when they've come through the door, the sex life is waning, or they're not on the same page at all, and then eventually when they sort of graduate from what you're working with them, what's the biggest change that you've seen?
Yeah. I think just being able to be curious and open about, you know, their partner's sexual interests, even if they don't necessarily see themselves participating or wanting to do that with their body, you know, they're receptive and actually are happy that their partner is telling them about it. And then the other partner, you know, isn't feeling as rejected and doesn't feel like they have to, you know, kind of pressure their partner into doing it. They can also accept that, you know what, this isn't something that can be part of our sexual repertoire, but we can at least talk about it. And I don't feel judged for having this fantasy or interest.
Mm. Do you find that ethical non-monogamy and polyamory comes up more often? It and I don't know whether it's just the media sort of caught onto it the last couple of years, but it just seemed to be the, I don't know, almost the dish of the day. It's like, well, it's ethical non-monogamy. Yeah. And I always think it's, unless unless you've got a strong foundation, I think I can't imagine how that can suddenly fix everything. So you have a bad relationship. I know what. Let's go and date other people. Do you have that conversation with people?
Yes. Okay. Yes, absolutely. Because you're 100% right. Couples that are practicing ethical non-monogamy need to have better communication skills, more trust, more emotional regulation than monogamous couples. And so if I'll have couples that have been polyamorous from the beginning and are just wanting to work on, you know, sex within their relationship, but the couples that are wanting to open up that have been monogamous for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, you know, oftentimes we have to go back and put a pause on that and work through some of the issues that existed previously.
So I talked to just somebody that sort of specializes in polyamorous coaching, and her relationship is non-monogamous, and she was saying there's so many, it's like a Baskin's Robin. There's so many flavors to it. So some are, you know, we invite anybody in, some are don't tell me, do tell me, one person, not one person. It's like, where if you're in a regular couple, there's two people generally and that's it. Whereas, don't think polyamorous relationships are less complicated. She said it's a whole new ball game. Who do you spend the holidays with? What about if there's children involved? What about the finances? There's so much more to it.
Yes.
So everything's about communication, isn't it, ultimately? If you can find a 100%. Way to talk about things, it's,
communication, negotiation, empathy, and understanding.
Just touching on something that must be very difficult to work with as a therapist is if somebody's been through a traumatic experience and perhaps years ago, and perhaps it's suddenly just come to mind recently, and particularly sort of sexual trauma. And I'm shocked anymore, I'm not really. I'm always very distressed by a number of women that I talk to who have had a sexually traumatic experience. And to be fair, it's like 95% of women I talk to have had, to one degree or another. I'm not saying they've all been raped, but from one degree to another,
they've
had some experience that they did not like and did not enjoy, and it's left some residual scarring, if you like, internal emotional scarring. Where do you start? Where do you start when that comes out, either as part of a couple's dialogue or as an individual? What do you do?
I think, again, it's just meeting them where they're at. Like, are you ready to address this yet? Because sometimes sexual violence survivors aren't ready for, you know, until years after the trauma to process it. So, but if they are, typically, like, I use EMDR, which stands for eye movement desensitization reprocessing. It's a whole mouthful. But I use that to help them rewire and desensitize that memory. And then when they're ready to reconnect with their body and pleasure, I'll use a technique called Sensate Focus, which is a series of like mindfulness touch exercises that you can either do solo or with a partner. You know, if you're wanting to be sexual in a relationship, eventually you're going to have to do them with a partner. But sometimes with sexual trauma survivors, you know, they need to start by themselves first, so they feel 100% in control and, you know, build that safety layer upon layer. And that helps them work through it.
Yeah, because you do want people to be able to progress. Because I guess people I've talked to anyway, handle trauma in different ways. Some people blame themselves. Some people become very sexually active, almost as a "you can't hurt me" type mechanism. Some people treat within themselves, and it like you say, I think the skill that you obviously have is that ability to very quickly diagnose where they're at and what defense mechanism they've developed.
Yes.
And then to work forward from, okay, well, you've done nothing wrong, and it's not, however you've handled it, however you've gone about trying to mitigate it, but here's how perhaps a healthy version of that might look. Is that what it feels like?
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes, especially with sexual violence survivors, it's just helping them understand like all the myths that exist around, you know, sexual violence, because there's so much victim shaming and blaming. And it's oftentimes not even the initial trauma, the assault, that's the most traumatic. It's the aftermath of, you know, telling people, trying to make a police report, and just being told, well, you know, so many things like, are you sure that really happened? Why didn't you say no? What were you wearing? All of those icky things.
It's horrible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so awful.
And from the limited experience I've had talking to people, it's often from people that they know and are close to. Yeah. Like, say, the whole, what were you wearing? Why did you drink so much? Why did you go back to his room? What did you think was going to happen?
Yes.
All of those things. That,
uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, in the UK, it was only, I think, 40 years ago, there was no such thing as rape within marriage.
Yeah. So, I think the US is similar. Uh-huh.
It's extraordinary. And I try and my 18-year-old daughter and 15-year-old son, I try and explain to them now, no, that can't be right. But yeah, I can remember when I was growing up, a big deal being made out of the law changing. But yeah, so within a marriage, the husband almost had, I don't know, ownership rights, or could do
ownership.
It. There could be done for physical violence, but actually, yeah, that sex was just part of what was, should be there on demand. Should be there on
demand. Entitlement. Yeah. Ugh.
Just because so many sexually traumatic experiences happen within families, within close relationships. You know, that
the
sort
people,
of
people. Yeah, the people you know.
I know that thing about, you know, being attacked on the street or being attacked on the subway, or whatever. Yes, it happens, but it's the 1%. It's the 99% that happens is somebody that you know, which makes it harder.
Yeah.
On that topic, how do you protect your mental, I guess, and physical well-being? You obviously hear a lot of things, and people aren't generally coming to you and saying, everything is wonderful, I just wanted to book an hour with you, just tell you how great things are. They're generally coming to you when things are difficult, and sometimes, you know, very difficult. So how do you avoid carrying that trauma with you after the sessions? How do you nourish yourself?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing that I've had to learn is knowing my limits. You know, how many clients can I see? What types of issues will I work with? Mm-hmm. How many hours a week do I work? I'll see my own therapist to process through things, especially, you know, sometimes there are things you hear, images that kind of stick with, I'm very imaginative. So that can be strength and also, you know, a problem when you're talking about, you know, awful things that happen to people. Yeah. So I'll see my own therapist, and then I make time for me and the things that I love. So getting out in nature, at least once a week, that's huge for me.
Yeah. It's amazing how valuable that is. Like, I can tell. I've got a little dog who's fabulous, and I can tell if I go out in the morning, which is the norm, or for some reason I don't go out in the morning, my whole mood changes. So being physically outside, it is such a, because we've always had this thing, I think, as humans, that we've always seen like us and nature, as opposed to thinking that, well, we are nature, we're all part of it, and it's just
we
don't regard ourselves. Yeah. So my final question has to be, what does the, are you a forward-looking person? What does your future look like for you? You're still studying, you're still wanting to learn more and more, and I know you're really keen to know everything and absorb everything. So what does the future look like for you, think?
Yeah, I think just more of running my own practice. I don't ever see myself wanting to run a group practice. I just want to be, a solo clinician, and then working remotely so that I can travel more freely with my partner. I think that's ultimately our big vision for now. Who knows? It might change, but right now that's what we want. So
Any you're happy at the moment?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think happiness is a feeling that comes and goes. So would I say I have passion, purpose, meaning? Yes, which I think those things are more sustainable than happiness alone.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. It's very generous of you. You shared a lot. And yeah, I'm really interested to listen back. So we'll get it out there and get people to listen. And yeah, just
Yeah, thank
have a
you
little
so much
fun.
for having me. This was a wonderful conversation.
Absolute pleasure.